Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Let's be blunt. Imagine yourself, or if you're a male, imagine your teenage daughter or your sister trapped in a public restroom, caught off guard by menstruation. No tampons available for love or money. The plight of every woman who's had to quote-unquote MacGyver her way out of that one has sent our first guest on a mission. It's called Free the Tampons, and its founder, Nancy Kramer, whose business is in marketing and the largest female-owned digital advertising business in the country, joins us in the studio to tell us more. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thanks, Ann. Thank you.
So I guess the first question has to be, when did the idea for Free the Tampons occur to you?
Well, I've been thinking about this for over 30 years. The first time I had ever seen the supplies in a public restroom was in 1982 at Apple's corporate headquarters.
And so one of your first clients.
Our first client. And it had a profound impact on me. And I thought, why isn't this like this every place in a public space? And I traveled a lot. And so I found myself being caught without the supplies I needed frequently, even though I had them all packed on me.
And best plans laid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, use things faster than you anticipate, all those kinds of things. And so I literally have been thinking about this for 30 some years. But actually, on the occasion of my 50th birthday, 8 years ago, my now husband really gave me the domain name Free the Tampons as a internet domain name to try to encourage me to really think about how to take this into the public conversation, because he's known that I've thought about this for so long. And between us, we have four daughters.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday today. My guest for the first segment, Nancy Kramer. She's founder and chair of Free the Tampons. Okay, so Free the Tampons is sort of a double entendre, right?
Mm-hmm,
tell us what the doubleness is there.
Well, I mean, the whole fact about that we are trapping them, if you will, in vending machines that often are broken or that they're not there at all, but it's really meant to have free accessibility to tampons and pads. I'm using tampons and pads interchangeably. I've had people say, what about pads? And of course we mean that. I mean, the whole idea is that a woman should not be in the situation that you just described, that you should never be in a situation that you don't have the supplies that you need when you need them. I mean, toilet paper's there. It's free. I think this is the same thing.
Is it, some people might say that tampons are pretty expensive, pads are pretty expensive. Is there a cost factor here that maybe has prevented this, or do you think there's something else?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that it's primarily been awareness. The survey that we did this summer, talking to all kinds of people, really gave us the feedback that some of it is just awareness. This is an issue a lot of people just haven't even thought of. Certainly, there is some minimal cost associated with it. A statistic that I often quote is what it costs us in our own business to offer these supplies free. And for an entire year, per every female associate that we have in our business, the cost is $4.57. So less than a fancy cup of coffee at Starbucks, for that same amount of money, you can provide these supplies to women in restaurants, businesses, institutional, public spaces for a pretty nominal fee. What we have discovered is once the items are there in a space on a regular basis in the school that I have convinced to supply, once people realize that they're there, they're not taking them and hoarding them, if you will. It's not super common that people take toilet paper. I mean, some people take toilet paper, and there's always going to be people that do that. But for the most part, once things are freely accessible, they're become less desirable.
When I heard you talk about this at TEDx Columbus a few weeks ago, you noted that traditionally in schools, girls mostly have to go to the nurse's office mm-hmm. if they're caught unawares.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And
that's where the wellness portion of this.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I think it's kind of ironic that we send our daughters in schools to the nurse's office if they need supplies, like they're sick. And the truth is if a young girl is menstruating, she's very healthy. And I'm interested in digging a little bit deeper in that issue. We've talked about doing some additional research around that very issue and the psyche that plants in a young girl's mind. But I think it's just kind of crazy that we do that to our young daughters.
Another sense I got from listening to you at the TEDx Columbus was that in the crowd, how many people were nodding their heads. What do we know about how common it is that women and girls are caught off guard?
Well, we did a pretty extensive research study this summer with Harris Interactive, and we surveyed women 18 plus in the United States that menstruate. So we did a statistically sound sampling of them. And what we found out was nearly 9 out of 10 women have been caught in public spaces without the supplies they need. So this really is a universal issue. There's certainly some discomfort around talking about it, but it is an issue that virtually every woman has experienced, and every woman has a story. And I think that the more we can talk about it and become a little bit more sensitive to it, then perhaps it has a hope of really spreading.
My guest is Nancy Kramer. Once again, we're talking about Free the Tampons. It's a movement she has founded. You can get a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. If you have a question for Nancy Kramer, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So what has the response been to this?
Well, it's been really incredible. We've had all kinds of different media people. I was on Huffington Post last week doing a live hangout with a variety of women that are very much supportive of the idea. I've gotten letters from people, notes from people, outreach, people like the UAW saying, this is something that we negotiate in our contracts for our female associates. We're trying to validate how extensive that goes, but mm-hmm. we've confirmed that there are a couple of spots where UAW, as an example, provides those supplies for women. We have a Twitter campaign that we're launching that people are sharing with us, the places where they're finding tampons free or pads free or supplies free, and sharing that with us. And we've had some really great response. And I just was looking at a link last night that was for a magazine in France that was talking about this whole movement. So it's starting to get out. It's a startup, but the message is starting to take hold.
You've focused on the emotional toll that being caught off guard by your period in public can take.
Mm-hmm.
What do we know about that? 9 out of 10 women have been in that position. What happens to them?
Well, 79% of them talked to us in our sample about the fact that they've been forced to improvise with toilet paper or some other
MacGyver
their way out. Yeah. But it's embarrassing. People talk to us in great detail about the humility how humiliating it was for them, embarrassing, and how it produced so much anxiety in a woman. I think that we don't even begin to understand how stressful this situation is for women every month to be forced to not know when this is going to happen to their body, and that they could be in a position where they don't have what they need. And so there's unfortunately not an equal physical experience for men to really comprehend what this is like, but it's an incredibly stressful situation for women.
Maybe something men should talk about with their partners, their spouses, their daughters.
I do think that that would be really helpful. It was funny because just yesterday I was having a conversation with someone who was at my TED Talk who said, I hadn't really thought about it, Kramer, but I remember going out on a date with someone in high school who was in my car and they got their period, and how embarrassing it was for both of us and how he helped her through this situation. He's a very sensitive guy anyway, but I mean, the kinds of, it's kind of bringing up an awareness to people of things that they haven't thought about for years.
And how do you, what going forward, how do you see this movement unfolding?
Well, right now we're in an awareness phase to just really start the conversation and see how people react to it. And we've had, you know, there's some people that don't want to talk about it. They feel very uncomfortable. And I understand that. It's a little uncomfortable for me. But I made a pledge to my daughters that this was something that I would want to really tackle before I die, and I'm not getting any younger. So that's been my motivation. But this first phase is an awareness phase, and then we'll hopefully get to a point where we start sharing data with people about all the places where there are supplies freely accessible, not only just here locally, but across the country. And that's the goal. And so that it creates more and more awareness about it.
An email from Jan. I grew up before we could even mention tampons publicly, much less ask someone at a restaurant for them. I don't know how many times I had to sidle along a school wall to get out the door after an accident.
Mm-hmm. It's just amazing. Every woman has a story. Every one of us has a story of that kind of situation.
You went to your daughter's school and asked them to start supplying these. What was the response?
Well, at first, the head of school, a male head of school, was really taken aback that I was talking to him about this. But then he thought about it, and he has two daughters. And after a lengthy conversation about it, and I came armed with an understanding of what the realities of the economics were and what the solution could be and how to operationalize it by simply opening up the machines that already existed in the school. So I kind of came with the solution and understanding what the cost would be. And after a conversation with me for about an hour, he was convinced that that was something that they should do, and we worked with the facility staff to make it happen. I've also talked to a number of businesses about it and convinced them to do the same in their business and in restaurants, and specifically Cameron Mitchell. If you go to any Cameron Mitchell restaurant, you'll find the supplies are free.
Beautifully displayed.
Beautifully displayed. The wonderful Danis family that own Filio and Vino Vino, same thing. I went to them and said, you have three daughters. We should be supplying these things for them. And they followed suit as well. So I'm going from working on this little bit by bit on an incremental level to a much larger national awareness around this.
You told a story about an airport, that you actually were in an airport.
Yes.
Where they expected you to. I mean, how many of us have been in an airport bathroom? You usually don't have that much time. This is usually after waiting in line after a flight has disembarked. Did they want you to go down to a magazine counter?
Yes, I was so taken aback because I was in LaGuardia, and there above the paper towel dispenser, because paper towels are free, seat covers are free, soap, everything else is free, but there was a sign that said, feminine care products may be purchased at Hudson News on the main in the main terminal and on all concourses. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, so here I am getting ready to board a flight. Now I have to go find Hudson News and stand in line there and then come back to the restroom and stand in line, and all before I catch my, as you think about it and the absurdity of that, I was really taken aback by that. I mean, there are some public spaces, like in Boston, for example, they have signs in their restrooms that say, go to our guest services if you need these supplies. But LaGuardia, I thought, took it to a whole nother level.
Well, Nancy Kramer, thanks for joining us today to talk about this. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anne.
That is Nancy Kramer. She's a founder of Free the Tampons. She is also the founder and chair of the largest female-owned digital advertising business in the country. So it's called Resource. Coming up, we'll talk about more wellness issues on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous often describe feeling stuck, out of control, and afraid of change. The thing is, members of Weight Watchers or Workaholics or an anger management support group will describe the same feelings. And it's no coincidence. There is a connection. Joining us now in the studio to talk about that is Christopher Kennedy Laufer. He is the author of several books, including most recently, Recover to Live, Kick Any Habit, Manage Any Addiction, and the forthcoming What Addicts Know, 10 Lessons from Recovery to Benefit Everyone. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Ann.
So you've written several books on addiction and recovery, and you've talked to hundreds of experts about the statistics and methods, but you know from personal experience what it's like to struggle with dependency. Tell us about that, where you're coming from.
Well, you know, the first thing people have to remind themselves is this is a brain illness. The brain is an organ of the body. This is about chemistry, not about character. And the reason I did this book is because my advocacy has taken me all over the world, and there's still so much stigma and shame when it comes to this illness. So dependency, I describe, dealing with addiction as like dancing with an 800-pound gorilla. It's enormously difficult, enormously challenging. People who survive it and find recovery are enormously willful, gifted people who become exceptional in recovery. This is lost on society. The point of this book was we are more than just good for putting down the drugs and the alcohol or the food or the sex or whatever the behavior, whatever it is. So the dependency is difficult enough to survive. And then in addition to that, you've got to survive society's shaming of you. Not acceptable.
In your forthcoming book, What Addicts Know, you have an introduction titled The Gifts of Addiction, and gifts is in quotation marks. Could you tell me what you mean by gifts and that giftedness?
Well, there's a lot of it, but I think for me, and I'll speak personally, both of my parents struggled with this illness. We know from the research that an adolescent who suffers trauma in their adolescence is much more susceptible to this disease, especially if they have the genetic programming. So I had this I started at 12. It took me until I was 30 to get sober. But what I realized was it gave me an appreciation for life. It also gave me a connectedness to myself. It gave me and I believe, my friend or Carl Jung said that all addicts are looking to touch the hand of God. And I believe the people that I've met here are seekers. They're looking for something. They're looking for something more out of life. They're not just content to accept the status quo. And a lot of people are medicating, don't get me wrong. And they're, 50% of the people that have active addiction also have mental illness. And, I'm in town to speak at the NAMI event tonight, NAMI Franklin County at the Art Museum. And I hope everybody comes down to see me. But this is an issue that is complicated. And by putting this book out, What Addicts Know, people are like, what do you mean, what addicts know? They know how to take drugs and drink and whatever. No, they know a lot more than that.
When I was in a Smoke Stoppers course about 30 years ago, I remember there was a woman in the course who was struggling even more than I was. And I remember her referring to cigarettes as her best friend, mm-hmm. and breaking down, and that she was giving up her best friend.
Right.
There's an emotional issue there that it really, really resonated with me and made me so afraid of ever making something like that a best friend.
Right.
but she did personify it that way.
Right. Tobacco is interesting, you know, because, I mean, we know how harmful it can be, but we don't understand that that's the most profound delivery system for a drug in the world. I mean, it's instantaneous. It's more immediate than putting a needle in your arm. And tobacco has the same effect and the same efficacy as heroin when it comes to suppressing feelings. Okay? So your friend was basically saying, I can't take life. It's too difficult to feel this. We are, and we've gotten away from this as a culture, but we are feeling beings. In my estimation, this is one of the things I learned. You asked about the gifts of addiction. I mean, the spiritual nature of life. Addicts have to grapple with that. They have to grapple with the necessity of community. They have to grapple with, and these are not new ideas. I mean, the spiritual teachers have been talking about this for eons. They have to grapple with taking their own inventory, focusing on themselves, not on other people. How often in society do you see everybody looking at the other side? I mean, we see that now in our political culture, the polarization. What are we doing? What am I doing for this situation? If all of us kept the focus on ourselves, which is one of the gifts that we learn in addiction, this would be a better world.
My guest once again, Christopher Kennedy Lawford. We're talking about his book, Recover to Live, Kick Any Habit, Manage Any Addiction. He also has written the book, What Addicts Know, 10 Lessons from Recovery to Benefit Everyone. That's coming out in January. He will be at the Barnes & Noble in Easton today at 1, signing his book, Recover to Live. If you have a question or comment for him, we still have a few minutes. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and it's Wellness Wednesday. You use the term toxic compulsion sometimes rather than addiction. Why is that a better fit?
Well, again, it gets back to stigma and shame. Addiction is, people don't like that word. They don't buy books with that word in the title. And I'm interested in getting the message out. I'm interested in obliterating stigma and discrimination. There are 13,000 laws on the books across the country that discriminate against people in recovery from toxic compulsions. This is not okay. This is either a brain illness or it's not. I understand that oftentimes people who suffer from these things act out in ways that are illegal. That should not be tolerated. But we really have to get to, you know, how are we going to look at this thing? Toxic compulsion seems, I mean, I struggled with it, but it was the best I could do in terms of coming up with a way of describing these, whether they're chemical issues or behavioral issues.
What do I, you know, it just so happens that last night, for the first time in probably years, I watched part of a segment of The Biggest Loser, and it was interesting to hear what these folks had to say about their struggles and why they were trying to get healthy in terms of their diet and exercise and so forth. A lot of it had to do with their children or their family and that sort of a thing, but also that it was killing them. But beyond that, what do alcoholism and an inability, or not an inability to lose weight, but somebody who's eating too much is probably the better way to put it, have to do with each other?
Well, you mean what is this similar? They all center in the brain, basically,
and still.
They still do. And food is difficult. Food and sex, these behaviors that you have to engage on a daily basis. I was just talking to somebody actually here on the Ohio State University campus who said basically when you're dealing with alcohol or drugs, you slay the dragon of addiction. When you deal with food, you have to take the dragon out three times a day and pet it. You know, it's a difficult thing for folks. And all of us, this is the other thing, all of us who have one of these toxic compulsions, and I liked drugs particularly and alcohol, have struggled with these other behavioral issues in recovery because it's something within me that needs to, now my thing is hot yoga. I do it every day, religiously. I go and I love coming to places like Ohio in the winter because I can take a hot bath and a really cold shower and lie on a bed for 5 minutes and my brain shuts off. So it's all about the noise up here, the monkey mind, as some of the spiritual folks have talked about, that drives us a little nutty and into behaviors that satiate that. Food satiates, tobacco satiates, gambling, anything like that. It can rev you up, but at the same time, and at the end of the day, it's all about control. As a human being, we have no control. We were born, then we're dying for the next 70 or 80 years. We can't do anything about it. We try desperately by controlling things. And these are easy to control.
I was just thinking about what you were saying about the discrimination aspect of this, particularly true of people who use drugs, particularly true of people who use illegal drugs, because food's not illegal, alcohol's not illegal, exercise can be an addiction, that's not illegal. There's all these things that are not illegal that really it does rest in the individual. There's nothing society's going to do to help.
That's right. That's right. Yeah,
or hurt by helping.
Right. Right. And I think, I think we're beginning to see a better understanding. I mean, we're seeing now just policy-wise, an emphasis on drug courts. And we're looking at, obviously, the marijuana issue is a big issue, and that's a complicated issue. But decriminalization, or, that's not a term that folks like that much, but the fact that we're beginning to see these things as medical issues and not just criminal justice issues.
Some of the lessons, like number 4, realign your relationships, are reminiscent of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gotten a few calls from people over the years of their 12-step program, I should say. How has AA influenced your ideas about recovery?
Well, I talk about 12-step programs. I believe in, Alcoholics Anonymous is an anonymous program. I think, but Bill Wilson, who started AA, was one of the co-founders of AA, said that AA should go out and talk about recovery because they know about recovery. They shouldn't talk about their association with Alcoholics Anonymous. So there's no question that this book is significantly influenced by the principles of 12 steps, which were significantly influenced by the principles of Jesus and Buddha and everybody else. So this is not, as I said, new material. It's new packaging. It's a new way of looking at it. Hopefully it will get into the hands of some folks who will never walk into a 12-step meeting. And it's a vehicle for me to go out and talk about stigma and discrimination.
A lot of times people, we could just take these, the ex-smoker, become proselytizers of anti-smoking they can't, that they're, that's all they can talk about is not smoking.
Right.
And I remember when I quit, I said, I'm not going to be one of those crazy anti-smokers. It took me actually some years before I told people they couldn't smoke in my house anymore.
Right.
As a matter of fact, what is that component of that need to go out and proselytize? Maybe that's a pejorative, but that need to go out and spread the word?
Well, no, I agree with that. And one of the brilliant things about 12-step programs is they talk about attraction, not promotion. So that I think one of the elements of this book is if this works for you, pick it up and use it. But I don't care if you do it or not. I mean, I think it would help you and it would benefit your life and it would ultimately benefit your family and the world and your community. But if you don't want to do it, don't, because it's too hard. People who are dying have a difficult time accepting these principles. Okay, so I'm not going to proselytize or promote or anything. I'm going to promote the book because that's what I do. My job is as an advocate, so I promote. But I throw the rope, I don't get in the water. And it's attraction, not promotion. If you're unhappy, you want to change your life, and you've tried a bunch of things, try this. It might work.
Shane, okay. Okay. All right. So you think our culture is somehow set up for addiction? Other cultures don't have a lot of the same problems we do. What is it? You mentioned internet addiction early in the book. That's probably something that can spread across cultures now, but lots of cultures ban any alcohol.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I have not immersed myself in other cultures as I have in the American culture, and I've only immersed myself in a specific strata of our culture. But looking at it broadly, I see that we are economic. We drive our society on the next thing. And Americans are constantly getting bombarded with the idea of what you have isn't enough and you need this. And that's what drives our economy, advertising and those kinds of things. So that's part of it. Internet is part of, you know, technology is part of it. I have dinner with my kids. They don't look up from their phones. And I was thinking, this is kind of a drag, but I understand it. It's a different culture. Is that addictive? I don't really know. I mean, I think we need to set boundaries around that if you want to engage your children. But I don't know what's right. I just share my experience, strength, and hope with folks, and this is what worked and what works for me. And I do this very imperfectly. I do it very imperfectly. Many of these are spiritual principles. They're not religious. They are about getting in touch with something deeper than the next thing.
Shane in Chillicothe, you're on the air with Christopher Kennedy Lawford. Welcome, Shane.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call. I have so many thoughts. Hopefully I can make them coherent. And
and within 30 seconds.
Has Mr. Lawford heard about ibogaine, and in particular ibogaine spelled I-B-O-G-A-I-N-E, used in the treatment of opiate addiction? And just to affirm and kind of jump in there in agreement with your interviewee there, Carl Jung said that the gods had become diseases. And, you know, we live in this culture that, you know, where tobacco and alcohol are legal and, you know, kill more people than all other illegal drugs combined. But yet we won't allow certain substances like ibogaine to be used in the treatment of addiction, which have been proven to be highly successful. The research is out there. So I just wondered if he had some thoughts to expand on that or if he'd heard of it.
Okay. Thank you, Shane.
Thanks, Shane. Thanks for the call. I'd just refer you to my book, Recover to Live. I think there's a lot of ways. I mean, I had my struggles with opiate addiction, and obviously there are a lot of effective treatments out there. This is a difficult thing to treat, obviously. Probably the most difficult. I agree with you in terms of the legal drugs being the most destructive to the individual and to society. It's one of the arguments that I make for not legalizing marijuana. I don't think we need another legal drug, but I appreciate your questions, and thanks for calling in.
All right. Thank you, Shane. Once again, Christopher Kennedy Lawford will be signing his book, Recover to Live, at the Barnes & Noble in Easton at 1 p.m. today. I want to thank you for joining us, for talking with us as well.
Yeah, and thanks so much. Appreciate it.
It's Christopher Kennedy Lawford. He's the author of Recover to Live, Kick Any Habit, Manage Any Addiction. Also, What Addicts Know, 10 Lessons from Recovery to Benefit Everyone. That's coming up in January. We'll continue on with Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Cleveland Clinic recently announced it would cut its staff to save $330 million. Vanderbilt University Medical Center also reported plans to eliminate 1,000 jobs by the end of the year. This news has some people wondering if there's a connection to Obamacare. The Cleveland Plain Dealer recently posed that question to the Cleveland Clinic and other policy analysts. Here with the answer is Stephen Koff. He's the Plain Dealer's Washington Bureau Chief. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, we're all on the edge of our seats, but before you enlighten us, we'd like to get a post-shutdown update on the healthcare.gov website. On Monday, the president himself expressed his irritation at all of the glitches.
And there's no sugarcoating it. The website has been too slow. People have been getting stuck during the application process. And I think it's fair to say that nobody's more frustrated by that than I am.
So what's the plan to fix it now, Stephen? Is there any way around those glitches?
The plan is to bring in big guns and smart people and pray and hope that they can fix it. It's not going to be quick. I mean, if my experience with it is any indication, I don't know that President Obama is the most frustrated person with it. I would say that any other American who's gone on it is frustrated with it. It's difficult.
What is difficult about it? You know, just for those of us who signed up for, we signed up for lots of stuff now. What's so difficult about it?
Well, you can go, you can do two things on the site, or you should be able to do two things on the site. But right now you can only do one of them. And that is you can sort of take a look in a hypothetical world and you can say, okay, I live in Ohio. So you click Ohio and then you click your county and then you say you're looking for a medical plan or you're looking for a dental plan. And then you say you're looking for family coverage or just a single coverage or an adult couple. And then it takes you to a page or two that says, well, here are some of the plans that, hypothetically speaking, these would be the rates. But that's not telling you your precise rates. It's really not telling you enough because there are certain health factors, there are certain age factors. Smoking is not even considered in there. Now these might reflect small variations in your rates. So let's say it says, okay, your premium, before you even consider subsidies or anything like that, let's say it says are going to be $500 a month for a for Anthem's XYZ plan, or $490 a month for Kaiser's ABC plan. Doesn't tell you what those plans are, doesn't give you much information on that. So we say, okay, let's get more specific. To do that, you actually have to register, get a username and a password, and log in. That's where the problems start, because you can get your password, then you can't log in, or I can't log in over and over and over. So I think maybe I put in the wrong password, and I put in, you know, your standard prompts as you would for any website, when maybe you don't remember your website, and it says, oh, we're going to send you an email reminder. Mm-hmm. But the email reminder never comes. Mm-hmm. And this happens over and over again. If you were buying a product, and let's say Land's End or Amazon site treated you that way, you'd say, bye, I'm taking my business elsewhere.
But you can't do that.
But you can't do that, exactly. So that's a frustration. On the other hand, look, it's really, really early.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's October 23rd. We have until the beginning of January before these health plans really kick in. So hopefully within the next few weeks, within the next month, things will improve. At the same time, that's going to create more crunch time as everybody who can't get on now rushes to get on then.
Is there any indication that they just why didn't they hire someone from Amazon right off the bat to create this website?
That's a wonderful question.
Yeah.
That's a great question. You're going to have people, by the way, from the various tech firms coming in testifying in the House of Representatives over the next few days. And then next week, I suppose, Sebelius, the HHS secretary,
right,
will finally be there. But, you know, lots and lots of questions, not enough answers.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to the question of how the Affordable Care Act is affecting hospitals. These cuts that I was mentioning earlier, they look deep. $330 million from Cleveland Clinic is a lot. Do staff cuts mean longer waits in the emergency room and more mistakes from overworked doctors? But the bottom line is, what effect does it have? What does the ACA have to do with them?
Well, the ACA has only a little bit to do with them, and it's really hard to quantify exactly what, unless you can really dive into the internal accounting of each hospital, and that's difficult, if not impossible, to do with the case of, let's say, the Cleveland Clinic, because it is it's a nonprofit hospital, and they don't have shareholder reports to put out, although they do have tax forms, and they do those tax-exempt forms do provide actually quite a bit of information. But understand that a hospital gets its money a few ways. One of those ways is patients come in with health insurance, and they pay for their care through their health insurance, and maybe they pick up some of their own costs through their deductibles and their copays. But the federal government provides a lot of money to hospitals through Medicare, which is the program for insuring senior citizens, and Medicaid, which is the program for insuring low-income Americans. To pay for the Affordable Care Act, that is to pay to expand health care to more Americans, the government needed money. So among the things it did is took money away from some money away from Medicare reimbursements. That is the amount of money that it might pay, Medicare might pay for, let's say, a dialysis treatment, or it might pay in an emergency room to a physician, putting a cast on a broken arm or a broken leg or any number of hospital operations. There mm-hmm. are lots and lots of these things. It did the same thing with Medicaid. Now, the theory is, guess what? We don't have to give you as much money for these programs because you're going to pick up a whole lot more people who have insurance, and that will make up the difference. You cut it here, but you make it up over there. The problem becomes this. Medicare reimbursements are never ending. I mean, you hear from doctors every year saying they're cutting. And therefore, in a way, the Medicare portion of this might get a bit of a bum rap when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, because there have been bigger cuts, much bigger cuts, since the Affordable Care Act even passed Congress. And nobody, well, I shouldn't say nobody, the hospitals certainly do complain, providers do complain, but the public doesn't say, doggone it, Congress, quit cutting our Medicare. They only say that in the context of the Affordable Care Act because they don't like the Affordable Care Act. But it's still a real factor for hospitals because it is a little bit less money. And the Medicaid portion of it is particularly important here because the theory was, well, we're going to give you less money for treating poor patients. Yeah, besides the Medicaid payments themselves, which are always pretty darn close to the line, if not under the amount that hospitals and doctors say that they really need to treat these patients, mm-hmm. the hospitals have gotten something called disproportionate share payments if they treat a number of low-income Americans, the theory being, well, you got to get the money somewhere, so we will give you a little bit of extra money to help take care of them. That money is being cut. Some of that money is being cut pretty substantially, the theory being that's okay, you're not going to have as many uninsured people coming in. They're going to be covered by Medicaid. But as we all know in Ohio, that's been a big question mark. Will states indeed expand Medicaid or not? And with that question mark comes, what happens if not? What happens if we don't get more people who come in who are now covered by Medicaid and we still have our disproportionate share money cut? You got to make it up somewhere, and that's one of the reasons the Cleveland Clinic says it has to look at making some staff cuts.
But the Ohio's controlling board on Monday voted to expand Medicaid to some 275,000 Ohioans. Does that? And on the other hand, there's a lawsuit already being filed contesting how that was achieved. Be that as it may, would that make a difference for Ohio hospitals now that Ohio is one of the 25 states supposedly expanding?
Yes. Okay. Yes, yes, yes. It should absolutely relieve some of that pressure on the hospitals. I mean, the Ohio Hospital Association has testified in Columbus numerous times saying, please expand Medicaid because otherwise we have given up that money. It's not our choice. Congress did it, but mm-hmm. it's gone, and you need to make it up somewhere. And as you know, the state legislature said, sorry, no. Well, that changes now. So now, indeed, that relieves some of the pressure.
But what about the uncertainty of this lawsuit? I mean, do hospitals still have a cause for feeling that uncertainty until it – and even then – it's like this giant machine that someone has to put the first quarter in and get going.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, but that's not necessarily new for hospitals because every year, I mean, it is a large amount of money in this case, but every year somebody is tinkering with Medicaid and particularly Medicare reimbursements. So it's an ongoing thing. It is in fact, why your major hospital organizations, it is why Ohio State University and others have lobbyists who are constantly talking to members and staff people in Congress and in the state legislature, because behind the scenes, this is constantly happening.
My guest is Stephen Koff. He's Cleveland Plain Dealers Washington Bureau Chief. We're talking about hospitals and the relationship they have with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. If you have a question or comment for Stephen, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. The health care plans offered under the ACA are tiered, with bronze offering lower premiums and higher deductibles. Are hospitals worried that a lot of patients with these lower-level plans won't be able to pay for all of their deductible costs?
They are quite worried. This is really interesting. I had not known this until reporting this story. But even among people who already have insurance, there is a lot of bad debt left behind. Because let's say you've got a high deductible policy, $1,000, $2,000 or more. You've got a high copay. So you go into the hospital, your insurer is going to pay a certain amount of that. But what about the amount of money? What about that $1,000 or $2,000 or 20% copay? That's got to come out of your pocket. And there's a pretty good chance that you might not pay that. This is, by the way, one of the reasons why the hospitals and even your local doctor presses you to pay that money right when you show up for your appointment, or right when you show up in the emergency room, or they ask you if you have a credit card or whatever, because they know, their experience is that there is going to be a lot of bad debt. I was told by Fitch Ratings that roughly one-third of hospitals' bad debt comes from people who already have insurance. It's these high deductibles and these copayments that are a problem. So now, the Affordable Care Act is going to eliminate these massive deductibles, you know, the $10,000 and $25,000 deductibles. But there still are plans. The bronze plans, for instance, can still leave an individual with responsibility to shoulder $6,000 or so of a medical bill. So if somebody comes into the hospital with a bronze plan and they get their ailment treated and they walk out, but they still might owe $6,000 out of pocket. That's a big question mark for the hospitals. And they recover that?
Yeah. Do they recover it? They don't have a system like the disproportionate share that they get from Medicare. They don't, or charity care. I mean,
they do, but that's been cut.
Right.
So this all works together. And they absolutely worry about that. The Ohio Hospital Association has told me a bit about this, and I think that they said that hospitals in the state of Ohio in 2010 reported a collective $645 million in bad debt. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. Hang on. Okay, we're looking for calls right now. Phil in Delaware. Nope. Ann in Blacklick. Don't have her yet. Okay, Phil is there. Okay.
So they're doing it themselves.
Phil, hang on, Phil. We missed the first part of your comment. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
There was no mention made of the 15 states, I believe, that are doing it themselves and are getting outstanding results.
Okay.
And sign-ups. Isn't this a preview of what's going to happen when the federal system gets running full steam ahead?
Okay. I guess what Phil's talking about is some states did their own websites for sign up, right, Stephen?
Right. Some states said, you know, what's interesting about that is it kind of reflects the Medicaid issue as well. Many of those states that are doing their own were happy to also expand Medicaid. They also happen to largely be states that voted for Barack Obama in 2012. Our data analyst took a look at that correlation the other day and found it to be pretty clear. So, yeah. I mean, you look at the website problem. If Ohio had decided to start its own exchange instead of going on the federal exchange, Ohioans wouldn't have this problem. That's assuming that, of course, that, you know, Ohio would have had effective web operators and designers.
Well, it could have piggybacked on something existing, couldn't it have?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Phil, for that question. Real quick, Ann and Blacklick.
Yes. I think that a good part of what has been happening on this debate is the fact that the executive branch, the legislative branch, although they might be thought to be federal employees, are not, and a good many of the trial and errors would probably have been worked out if, when the law passed, they abruptly withdrew the health benefit package and said, guess what, people? Here's the site. You give it a try. It's a small audience. We'll try it out on you. first.
Oh, well. I see.
Because it's the same thing as happens when they shut down the government. Again, speaking as a federal employee, if I had pulled a bozo brain, such as certain persons, I, as a former federal employee, would have set my agency up for a tort claim, and I would have been in for a tort claim. They aren't accountable.
Okay. Well, all right. Thank you, Ann, for that. I guess that isn't something that Congress is worried about right now, Stephen. She's right. They're not having to sign up for this.
No, they're not. Well, you know, they have to deal with health issues as well. But absolutely, she's right. There's not enough accountability of members of Congress. She's right.
Okay. Stephen Koff, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. You're very welcome.
Stephen Koff, he's Cleveland Plain Dealers Washington Bureau Chief. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Julia Hyder, Andrew Zissler, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks to everybody for listening today. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter on WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.